Hello, everyone. My name is Zakia Sewell, and I want to welcome you all to the South Bank Centre and to this Woven Rhythms conversation curated by the lovely, the wonderful Nicholas Daly. Mm-hmm. Now, there's an incredible night of music, festivity, performances, maybe a little bit of raving ahead. And it's all kind of in a celebration of cultural fusion, cross-pollination and community. And this is where it all starts. So I'm very, very excited to be speaking to some legends, trailblazers, rule breakers of British music tonight. And we're going to be talking about punk and reggae and dub and DIY culture and politics and identity and hopefully some other things as well. And after our conversation, there'll be an opportunity for you to ask any burning questions that you have. So tuck those behind your ears and we'll get to that in a bit. But now let me introduce my wonderful panel. Here with me is Pauline Black, OBE, singer, actress, author, style icon and queen of British ska. She's the lead singer of The Selector, a trailblazing band which pioneered the two-tone movement in the 1980s, bringing together ska, rocksteady and reggae with punk and new wave sounds. Here on my right, in a wonderful hat, is Wu Lu, a producer, vocalist, and multi-instrumentalist from Brixton, whose debut album Loggerhead, which came out last year, fused punk, metal, and hip-hop influences with politically conscious lyricism. We've got Dennis Bevel, MBE, producer, DJ and dub master extraordinaire. Dennis played in the British reggae group Matumbi, was at the forefront of the lovers rock scene in the 1970s, and has produced for artists across the musical spectrum, from Slits to Orange Juice and Linton Kwesi Johnson. Give it up to Dennis. And last but not least, Delilah Holliday, a singer, songwriter and guitarist hailing from North London, although she's just moved south. At the age of 14, she set up a band called Skinny Girl Diet with her sister and cousin, which gained acclaim for its punk ethos and feminist spirit. Now she is focusing on making her own music, which combines dark electronics with R&B and trip-hop influences. Give up for Delilah. Hey! How's everyone doing? All good?
Very well.
Well and dandy. Happy to be here.
Yep.
Good, yeah. Good, good. So, right, this is a conversation about music, and I know that Nicholas was really keen for it to kind of be an intergenerational dialogue. So, to begin, it felt right to ask each of you to choose a track from the previous generation that inspired you or somehow had an impact on your life. So, I'm going to play a little bit of each track and then ask you to just say why you chose it. Pauline, I think we're starting with you, so I'll play the track and then you can tell us what it is.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, do you want to tell us what that was? And yeah.
Well, that was the Pioneers. It was Long Shot Kick the Bucket. And, I mean, personally, I was, like, I guess the first generation of, like, proper miscegenation that happened in this country. So to cut a long story short, that I was the only black kid in all the schools I ever went to. And and I didn't know any black people, and it was in Romford. I rest my case. You know, Romford was just, like, so awful. But it had a bright had a bright thing, because by the time I was 15, when this came out, there were skinheads at my school, because the catchment area for the school was Dagenham as well. And they had a fifth form common room. And they had an old red danzette. And they used to go over there, and I used to sort of sit around, kind of being a mascot, really. And they never really knew how to take me. But they used to do this formation dancing to these kinds of tracks. And that was the first time that I ever heard anything like that. And I was absolutely smitten. And just used to dance to it. And, you know, so my claim to fame is that I was introduced to ska, bluebeat, reggae, rocksteady by skinheads.
Amazing, thank you. I believe we've got Delilah's track next. If you can cue that. Oh, yeah. So what was that one, and why did you choose that one?
That's the Slits, Typical Girls, and this song, like, it's just had such a profound impact on me. I just feel like it's still relevant to this day, and, you know, especially with, like, social media and just getting caught up in, like, what being a typical, you know, female identifying person is. But yeah, this song, I don't think I'd be making music without the Slits, like, discovering them. And, of course, Dennis produced that track.
I'd be guilty.
But, yeah, it's just the lyrics and the production, and I just love how the Slits were influenced by reggae, which is something I'm influenced by in my own music. Yeah, it's just a great song all around.
Where did you first hear it? How did you discover the Slits?
Well, like, that's my mum. My mum, I have to shout out Mumsy. She played it for me, and, you know, I heard it at, like, 13, and that's, like, quite an awkward age for a girl. Like, you're going through puberty, like, figuring it out, like, who you want to be. And hearing those lyrics of, you know, like, fake smells and, like, I don't know what to wear. It's just, you know, it just really helped, you know, navigate that really awkward time. And with Skinny Girl Diet, our first name was actually Typical Girls. We named our band after that song and what would become Skinny Girl Diet. So yeah, it's just a very important song to me.
Amazing. Right, let's go into the next one. I realise that I'm holding the button, I'm in control, so I'm gonna press the Dennis's track.
Yeah.
Yeah, so tell us about that one.
Wilson Pickett. When I was about 13 years old, he had a hit with a song called Midnight Hour. I'm going to wait till the midnight hour. And when I got the chance to borrow records from my dad, I borrowed a Wilson Pickett album, which was called Midnight Hour. And the track that caught my fancy on that album was that song called Don't Fight It. And I remember playing with some older boys and them being, you know, amazed at the fact that I knew the guitar part of that song. And the guitarist was Steve Cropper. And Steve Cropper was a member of Booker T and the MGs. And he actually produced Otis Redding's tune, The Dock of the Bay. So I was a guitar player, so I was looking for a fancy guitar player. And he was also in that film, The Blues Brothers, right? Steve Cropper, amazing guitar player. And that song, for me, to actually sit in my bedroom with my record player, albeit that it was a 45 and I was playing it at 33, so I could follow the licks. And then I would have, when it speeded up, I'd have to transpose it to the right key, you know. So that song taught me a lot about transposing. And the beat was so ferocious, you know. And in the song, he actually says, everybody's dancing. They can't help themselves, you know. And later on, a friend of mine by the name of Tony, and he was affectionately called TC after Top Cat. And Tony and Wilson Pickett appeared at the Royal Albert Hall. And the pair of them screamed for about 20 minutes. You know, who could scream the loudest? You know, and I just became a big Wilson Pickett fan.
Did you, because it's interesting hearing sometimes people kind of, the tracks are like things that they've inherited from their parents, and some of us, we have the urge to sort of rebel against and resist what our parents kind of tried to offer us. So you obviously were willing to take on what your dad had to give you.
Yeah, well, my dad had a sound system. Mm. And he had, you know, lots and lots of records, and he subscribed to airmail. You know, he would order records from America, from Jamaica, from Nigeria, all, you know, to have, you know, his collection satisfy his friends, because my dad worked on London Transport, so he had friends from all over the world. And so when he played at the parties that they had, he'd have to play a bit of Fela Kuti, you know, a bit of Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, and then, of course, Prince Buster and all that. But I didn't quite get into Jamaican music, you know, because that was the music that my dad most played. So I held on to the funk. Changed later, though.
Yeah, more on that later. okay, and Wulu, your track is the last one. So let's
insight, that. Foresight, more sight. The clock on the wall reads a quarter past midnight.
What a tune. Yeah, tell me about that one.
Well, to be honest, I was pretty, like, not sure what tune to pick, and I thought, you know what, let me pick something that allowed me to go back into searching through my dad's and my parents' music. Mm. Kind of like similar to what you guys were saying about, like, you know, my parents were like, my mum's a dancer, my dad's a musician. And growing up around all of that, I would hear hip-hop and I'd hear Fela Kuti and reggae and ska and all this stuff in the house. But because it was so normal to me, I was just like, oh yeah, I want to get into turntablism. I want to get into scratchy and all that sort of thing. And then when I first heard this tune on a film that my mum showed me, a film called Scratch, I heard this tune in the background and it's by this guy called DJ Shadow. And I was just like, oh my God, this guy's playing all this stuff. This is amazing. And then I realized later on in my life, I was like, he didn't play it. He sampled it. Mm. I was like, oh. And then from there, I started digging into records and started going into all the music that my dad was into, my mom and my family. And I would, like, I'd pull out Bob Marley records and then find that the intros were like psych tunes, stuff to like flip on beats and stuff like that. So that tune, when I realized how it was made and all of that, it kind of pushed me into delving into all my parents' stuff and like a lot with different ears, you know what I mean? So that's kind of like where that tune sits for me in my creativity, you know? I had the thought, you know, someone who can bring together so many genres and do it in a way where it doesn't have to be like, you know, the normal way of doing stuff, that's what I want to do, you know what I mean? So that's why it's really important to me, man. And it's just like a beautiful piece of music. Mm. It's just like, it makes you kind of think. I found myself a lot of the time at home just listening to that tune, just lying on my bed thinking about, what would Andre 3000 say on this? Or what if Bob Marley had, like, if he's still alive today, would he be delving around in other genres to develop what he's doing? Because, you know, I was going to pick Concrete Jungle because the intro of that is so, like, not like how it comes in. And I was like, maybe that's it, but really, at the core of it, it's the sample culture, and that's a big representation, that tune for me, anyway, so that's why I picked it.
Because in a sense, you know, sampling culture is, it's a kind of intergenerational conversation, or it can be, because you're sort of taking snippets of these little fragments and echoes of the past and bringing them into a new, a new context.
Yeah, and it makes you listen, because, you know, I'm not necessarily, like, you might be in a record shop and just flicking through stuff, just trying to find interesting sounds. When you get home, like, you might find a piece. When you get home, you'll be able to be putting on the whole record. I'm listening all the way through, like, on each side, so I'm taking in all these different kinds of stuff. I might pick a tiny little bit. I might not even use it. I might forget what I picked it up for, but I'm taking in all the different parts of so much music. Like a digger's or a producer's record collection will just go back years and just be trying to archive what came before them. You know what I mean? So it's dope.
Well, thank you all for sharing your selections. Beautiful, lovely. Beautiful sounds. And I want to take it back to you, Pauline, because it sounds like your experience was slightly different from the others. Everyone else has sort of talked about this absorption from the parents, whereas you found your kind of musical family or musical community at a later stage.
Well, I mean, if my influences had been my parents at that time, it would have been Peters and Lee. It really was that bad. There was one old radiogram that they had, and my dad used to sort of stick that on and get all kind of lachrymose about, you know, the way she sang and things like this. So, well, that's Romford for you, I'm not gonna say, really. So, I mean, it was different in that way. I had to actually go out there and discover it and discover really as well what it meant to be black and or my idea, if you like, of what it meant to be black and take on what cultural things that I needed to, because at that time I didn't even really know what my parentage was. I kind of knew that my dad had been Nigerian. I kind of knew that my mother had come from Dagenham and she was this sort of 17-year-old kind of white girl who'd got up the duff kind of thing. So from that aspect, it was, I could choose what I liked, but it certainly didn't come from my parents. And it actually came, by the time I went to Coventry, it actually came from kind of, you know, young black youth who were there, who were very much into Marley and all those sorts of things at the time, and wanted to start a band. Some a white guitarist, Neil Davis, who wrote a lot of the stuff for The Selector, which he performed originally, but just as an instrumental band, not with vocalists or whatever. And he had just been playing with some, people who then went on to be in The Selector, down the Holyhead Youth Club in Coventry. And they were amazed that here was a white guy who knew how to play kind of, reggae offbeats and things. And likewise, he was amazed because he just thought the whole of black culture was really great. So into that came I at some point in time. And we formed the band and off we went.
Tell me what that kind of phrase two-tone means to you, and what did it mean then, and has your sort of relation to it changed? What does it mean now?
Well, I'm wearing two-tone. This is Nicholas Daly's, specially made. So, what does it mean to me? For me, back then, it meant a music that brought people together, brought black people, white people together. And, to celebrate all that was good about our cultures on either side of that particular fence, and see how we could bring them into some kind of hybrid form of music that would push the conversation forward. Equally, I was into, the whole typical girls thing and the Slits. They used to... The first time I ever saw an all-female band, I suppose, was at Coventry Theatre, and the Slits were there, and it was on that tour, a typical girls tour, and they were absolutely fantastic. And women seemed to be coming forward and having a voice at that time. They were not the backing singers. They were not kind of, bought in to pretty up the stage like Chic may have been at the time or these other kinds of things. They seem to be real and real women and talking about what women were about. I went right in there kind of thing. Polystyrene was around at the time. I mean, there were some really great women around at that time. But everybody just got on and did it.
How did it feel to be one of the only women of colour in that scene? Or was that, did you feel a solidarity? Did you have allies other than Polystyrene? That's the only other one I can think of.
I don't really think that we thought about it in that way. Mm. I mean, these are all kind of, there's a lot more of people who look like us now. You know what I mean? So that was a bit more few and far between, really, in those days. And Coventry's only got like 350,000 people who live there. And so it had quite a smallish black community with its origins, parents. I mean, what we were talking about were young people who'd come over at 12 and because their parents had been here first. And it's and those were the kind of kids that I got to know and started making music with. So we were influenced by a whole load of things. I mean, the other singer that's in the Selector, Gaps Hendrickson, I mean, he is just a walking encyclopedia of 70s pop music, 60s and 70s pop music, because that's what he heard on the radio when he first came. You didn't hear loads of black music. You'd have to go somewhere to hear black music, wouldn't you? But that was what you heard. And so when it came to putting all those things together to make two-tone, if you like, all those influences came from everywhere. And that's why I think it was such an exciting for that brief kind of period when it shone really brightly for 2 years between 79 and, say, 81, 82. That was why it was so exciting for young people to hear.
Mm. Now, you're sort of talking about this sort of hope for unity of black and white and that kind of being, the sort of foundation in a way of that sound. I'm wondering for you... Delilah, as kind of, in a way, you're the next generation from that scene, from those sounds. And when you were sort of part of Skinny Girl Diet and, another kind of all women of colour punk band, did you feel like the seeds that had been sown by Pauline and her generation, did you feel like they came to fruition? Was it a kind of a varied landscape or not so much?
I think that it has to... I feel like it has lulls, and I feel like like to what Pauline said, it's about the people that are just going out there and doing it and like sort of conjuring up that energy. Because it, I don't know, I don't feel like when you're like trailblazing, you kind of don't feel like you're supported. Mm. But then as long as you're doing it, you know, that's the energy.
Mm. I mean, you were quite young when you set it up, right? And it's very, it was very political music. Was that a kind of expression of your teenage angst? Is that something that sort of continued throughout your career? Are you still trying to sort of push kind of political messages with your music?
I just can't do anything else, really. It's done.
You say that like, oh.
I mean, it is like, sometimes I'm like, oh, it would be so much easier just to sing about nothing. But it's, there's something quite fulfilling about spreading a message that is relatable to other people that look like you or feel the same way. But yeah.
I'm kind of wondering, so I guess, you know, you all of you have this kind of relationship to the idea of punk, but obviously there's a kind of difference between those of you who were there while it was happening and those who've kind of got this received or memory of it as sort of transmitted through parents or, you know, history or the music. I mean, what does punk mean to you, Miles?
I mean, to be honest, I mean, a lot of people kind of like say to me, oh, yeah, you're on this punk thing. I'm just like, yeah, I'm just, to be honest, I'm just expressing exactly what I feel like in the moment or what, talking about what's in front of me. One of my biggest tunes is like, you know, quite a heavy hitting tune of talking about Brixton and, you know, kind of quite angry and quite angsty. And I guess there is the representation because people have come up to me and said, like, you know, you're doing a lot for like people of color in the punk scene. And I'm like, I hear that and I respect it and I love that you feel that way, but really and truly, I'm literally just saying what I see in front of my face.
Mm.
And I think that that is kind of the punk element that I'm kind of holding on to. I'm just going to like unapologetically say what I think. My opinion might change tomorrow, but I'm just going to let you know how I feel and let you know how the people around me feel as well. And I think that you can find the nuances of punk or jazz or hip hop or in any kind of music. I feel like you can find that in classical music if you dig hard enough. You know what I mean? Because I feel like you're just going against the grain of what people are trying to say what it is. You know what I mean? And I think that's punk in itself. And I think like, you know, coming out of a situation that you don't feel like you're being represented or you're getting what you want out of something, you just kind of do your own thing, and that's punk in itself.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Just kind of doing what the fuck you want. You know what I mean? And I think, you know, that's where I'm always going to be. So I guess I'm a punk artist. You
know what I mean? Punk.
You know what I mean?
So it's more of a kind of, it's more, for you, it's more of an attitude rather than, you're not really tying it to the genre as such. It's more of a kind of an energy.
It's just a headspace. Like, because in school, people would ask me, like, what are you? Are you a rude boy?
Mm.
Are you a punk? Are you a grunger? Well, I'm just Miles. I happen to wear baggy trousers today. I might be wearing a tracksuit tomorrow. That's pretty punk, right? You know what I mean? That's pretty, like, against whatever you think is going on. Just going with how you feel. And I think if you just follow your feeling in any generation and whatever you're doing, that's what's gonna make you happy. You know what I'm saying? And I think we were talking earlier about, you were saying that there's a lot more things to draw from the old school to be able to pull things together now. And I think that's just like a product of your environment. Like, you're, I guess, in your generation, you're pulling from, you know, what the experience is. Like, not being enough representation, not being enough people who look like you, or music that you're not hearing. And I think that's important about going back to go forward, you know what I mean? It's going to keep happening, you know what I mean? Completely. And I think that's pretty dope. Like, you know, if we inspire young people to just do what they want and go with what they feel, I guess we're inspiring them to kind of like, you know, be a punk, maybe, in some phrase, you know what I mean?
You're lucky you can do punk without the gob.
Yeah.
That's my main takeaway from punk. I was very grateful that they loved two-tone and all the rest of it, but when they turned up, man, just be flying at you. So you needed a raincoat.
Dennis, what about you? What's your kind of affiliation? You've talked about having, you know, feeling an affinity with the punks. What was that? Why was that?
Well, Chris Blackwell called me up and said, I've just signed the UK's first all-female punk band. And I think you're the person that I want to produce it. So I said, send me the tape. I listened to the demos, and I thought, these young ladies have got a lot to say. You know, and I was chuffed that they chose me because I was a reggae man. And what they wanted was the weight of reggae, how heavy it was, the bass and the drums and all that. Mm. And they wanted to incorporate that in their twiddly, twiddly, twang, twiddly, the guitaring, right? Because they had a sort of feminine touch, Viv Albertine on guitar. But then on bass now, Tessa Pollitt, she was very, you know, heavy. And some of the lines that she played, I was like, I wish I'd written that. You know? And that tune you chose, Typical Girls, they let me play piano, where I wasn't allowed to play any instruments. I was just the producer and to tell them whether I liked it or not, or try and guide them in the direction that they wanted to go with the sound. In fact, they confessed that when they heard Dennis Bovell was coming to produce them, they thought Blackwell had said Dennis Brown. So we went into the studio in a place called Ridge Farm in Capel in Surrey. And it was a residential thing. So I felt very much in control, because I was the one who said, right, we'll start at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, and then at 6 in the evening, I go, right, girls, off you go to bed. And Ari would go, I'm not going to bed. She was 15. And she would look at me and say, you're not going to work on my thing without me being there. Because she felt that I would wait till they'd gone to bed and then start twiddling things, you know.
Did you?
No. I wanted to, though. You know, like, for instance, Ari had listened to this production I made, Silly Games, with Janet Kay. And she was intent on showing me that she could hit a higher note than Janet any time, you know. And she was always all over the place. And whilst we were doing this production at this farm where we all lived, and we were there for 10 weeks or something, you know, I'd get a phone call from the record company. Are you done yet? No, it's coming. we've got the instruments down, and we're starting on the vocals now, you know. And, of course, when we started with the vocals, Ari had such a range, and she could play lots of instruments. I mean, she told me that when she was a kid in Germany, when her piano teacher would put a coin there and a coin there, and she had to play all the scales without the coin dropping off, you know. And, those young ladies kind of made it possible for a reggae man to produce a punk album, right? And the most frightful thing was the album cover. They decided to put mud on their bodies, strip off and mud up, right?
Legend.
And I'm going, I don't know. I can't show my mum that album cover. So what you been doing, Dennis? I've been working with these young ladies. Let's have a look. Is that them? You know, and my dad was going, you better watch yourself there, lad, you know. But it turned out that we grew together and had such a wonderful time together, and with me telling them, now your guitar's out of tune, tune that guitar to Viv all the time, or you know, Tessa. The guitars are not in tune, you know, and that they had no idea about what was tunefulness, but they wanted it, you know. And I was like the referee, go, no. And then when Ari would sing something horrendously out of tune, she'd go, I know it's out of tune, but I mean it to be out of tune. I go, fair enough.
So it was a kind of paternal role that you took on as, yes, a producer.
I was like their dad. And they were very rebellious. Mm. In fact, one time we were struggling with an acoustic guitar part, and I took the guitar from Viv, and I went into the studio and I said, I want you to do it like this. And she started crying. No. I said, what's the matter? She goes, no one's ever going to believe that I played that. So I thought, you're right, erase it. And the engineer and everyone's going, erase it, that's what the track is. Going, no, rub it out. Viv, you've just heard what I've done. Do your best to in that direction, you know. And when we did a song called New Town, the lyrics were, New Town where everyone goes around sniffing televigina or taking footballina. I thought, that's pretty out there, you know. If you, football is a drug, and so's television. That's another drug, right? And so I decided to play some percussion. And they sat in the studio looking at me while I took an ashtray, a spoon, a box of matches. And I kept going, the matches are going, ksh-ksh-ksh. And occasionally I'd take a match out and strike it, go, and then I'd take the spoon and hit it on the ashtray, go, ding, ding, ding. And it was supposed to be depicting drug taking, but in a different way. And once I'd done it, they sat there with their mouths open again. Okay, all right, you're catching flies now, shut up. Move on. And we'd been working with a console that belonged to John, the singer of Yes. Yes, we're on tour, and Mike, the engineer, decided to break out the equipment and set up a studio. But we weren't supposed to be using that equipment, but we were. And one evening, Ari scratched her name on the console. Ari was here. And she went, that's all right. John's a friend of my mum's. Well, he's going to find out now that we use this, you know, and... great time.
You know, whenever I sort of think about that, this sort of era of, you know, skinheads and punks and this sort of revive and this sort of, you know, surge of, you know, Jamaican music and reggae and dub, there was, seemed like there was this kind of unity between black and white, between these sort of different tribes. Pauline, do you feel like, you know, was that, is that true, or is that kind of, you know, a youthful, hopeful perspective and maybe lamenting what actually feels like a bit more segregated sometimes now?
I think at the time there was a lot to bring people together. Mainly, I mean, you know, the racism of the times, rock against racism, the Clash, you know, brought all those different strands together, started playing reggae in with their music. All of that was going on. And also you'd had a conservative government elected. So there was a lot to kick against. But I think that, you know, probably that catalyst was Eric Clapton sort of shouting his mouth off at Birmingham Odeon. Saying really racist and odious things. I think that when that got out, that kind of politicised probably a whole generation of blacks and whites, you know, and a lot of white kids were punks at that time, and black kids were kind of looking for their identity to be recognised and to come through, and so we found common currency in that kind of music that was around, so... you know, that mixing up of punk, of mixing up of, you know, early ska music, because reggae was already out there and that was kind of happening, and that was the scene, and that was very much sort of London and Birmingham centric. So this little old place, Coventry, was yeah, you know, where everyone thinks there that the best thing about Coventry is the M45, which is the road out. yeah, it was ripe for something to happen. And then, you know, bring that down to London. And then there was Madness, who, you know, seven young white guys who thought, oh, yeah, we've been doing that. We think Prince Buster's great, blah, blah, blah. And then the two-tone tour happened. And I think from that, that was kind of the first time that sort of blacks and whites, to a certain extent, had kind of peeped across the garden wall and said, yeah, we quite like what you're doing. And similarly, yeah, we'll have some of that. And then we were off. Mm. And look at you. No, honestly, that fills me when I hear things that you say, and that fills me with as though, yeah, you and me did something proper.
Aww. What do you think? Do you feel that those, you know, because actually when I think about the sort of music scenes now, although there is a lot more kind of hybridity and variety, I don't know if there's that same kind of unity, like people standing side by side in perhaps the way that Pauline, you've been describing. What do you think?
I mean, to be fair, I kind of think the opposite. Mm. Isn't it? I definitely, well, I didn't go to university. I applied and then did something silly, so I didn't go. Mm. But my dad was like, you need to get a job. You can't be sitting in my yard all day. You need to go and get a job. So he kind of put me in touch with, he's brought some ideas to me. He's like, there's a studio in Brixton called Raw Material. You should go and check it out. I was like, oh, I'm not good with the buttons and everything. He said, you should go. I was like, all right. There's a guy there called Tim Brown, this woman called Jenny, and a guy called JB. All kind of like, they've been working in this thing for a while. And I just basically spent from 23 or something to like 26 or so in the middle of Brixton. And that's where I sort of started finding other people that was into the same music as me. Because I used to be into like Flying Lotus and Beatsy stuff, and I didn't really have anyone around the area that was into it. Everyone's like, listen to So Solid or whatever, which is calm, which is blessed. But I found my community just from meeting some of the youngers and some of the guys from the area. And then this band came in from another organization called Tomorrow's Warriors, that's obviously a good thing, but mm-hmm. It was called TMV, I think they were called. And it was just these four black guys, a friend of mine called Reese now that I still hang out with. They were just doing the alternative hip-hoppy stuff and a few guitar-y bits and that. And I was like, where are you lot from? He said, oh, I'm from Brixton. Rafa's like, I'm from Brixton. Reese's like, I'm from Streatham. I'm like, where have you, man, been all my life? Like, I'm on the same thing. And so from that, just like the tiny little seed of just being in, having a place to be able to, like, you know, people to pass through, people from Angel Town, people from Loughborough, and you could kind of cross over, you just start finding it. And later on in life, I bumped into Mansell. You probably know Mansell Brown and that. He used to live, like, he used to live 3-4 doors down from me. I didn't even know until like 10 years later. And he was like, yeah, it's kind of hard being a guy from the ends and being into metal, isn't it? Mm. I'm like, yeah, what are you into? He's like, yeah, man. Because obviously he can play, so like crazy. And I clocked it, but it was that, you know, it was that sense of community. And then obviously my dad, he runs a thing called Youthsayers, off his band called The Soothsayers, and he really taught me about it's important, your community is important, and the ones who are coming after you and the ones in front of you, there needs to be some kind of middle ground and synergy between everyone. And so from not going to uni, getting a job, and going in a place where I could just kind of find my feet and just work out what I like doing, community was just like the biggest part of that, like proper. And then that just, obviously with the internet and all these sorts of things, as we were saying earlier, like, you know, you have accessibility to kind of see people who are similar to you, you know. I was into grime and I was into everything that people were into in my area, but I found my community just like, you know, like in little stages just from talking and meeting people and going to little events. And to be honest, actually, to hanging out at Stockwell Skate Park, you know what I mean? Like, you just kind of find people that are into, like, a bit more guitar music and also into hip-hop and also into, again, also into ska and also into the things that their parents are, know, given them, but are also open to finding other people that are into the same stuff. So I'm, you know, I think community is a massive part of it. And, you know, without community, we won't be able to build and find out new ways of doing stuff. And I'm a firm believer of that. My cousin said to me, she was just like, Miles is the kind of guy who will, if he gets any success in music and makes money out of it, he's the kind of guy who would probably give his money away to the community to be able to kind of like Noah's Ark his way through the people that are like into the same stuff. Because I'll be in the studio with young people and whatever, and they're like, I'm not too sure, I kind of want to do this thing, but it's a little bit not really against like what my friends are doing. I'm like, do that. If you like it, do that. That's sick. And you know what? You know, it's £50. Go and, you know, go and get a lesson in the keys, and if you're into it, come back, we'll make a beat, you go and do your thing. I think that is like what I love about, you know, music and being able to, you know, give back to the everyone, you know what I'm saying? And it's funny as well, you know, like obviously bumping into Dennis in the studio and that, and we were talking about it earlier, I used to live on the same road that he used to chill out with Linton, you know what I mean? And my dad and all of that, you know what I mean? So it's just like, it's the rehash. And we're just gonna keep going. And I'm sure, like when my dad moved to Brixton in like the 80s and that with my mom, it was like that community. He wouldn't have. He's from Worcester, you know what I mean? So like coming to Brixton and that, he kind of found his community and people that weren't in Worcester that he found, you know, he could relate to musically, and he passed that on to me, and I'm trying to pass it on to my brother and sister, and hopefully them on to, you know, keeps going. And I guess now we have community in our phones. You know what I mean? Mm. We can have like a WhatsApp group of guys in America and Streatham and Mitcham and whatever, but they're all into the same thing. So I think, yeah, that's where my head's at.
Global,
baby.
Global knows.
Delilah, I want to ask you, because, you know, just I know that when I was sort of growing up and I had this like split personality where I'd be like listening to all my kind of like grunge music and then my R&B and stuff on the side, but I felt I had to keep those worlds quite separate and private. No, when you were sort of, you know, listening to punk and stuff, what was your musical community? Who were the people around you, and were they, did you feel like you could express all aspects of yourself?
Hell no. No way. I used to be very like punky at school. I went to an all-girls school. I used to get bullied all the time, like, because I looked weird. And I mainly started Skinny Girl Diet, me and my sister, just so we had, like, somebody that looked like us and who could, you know, say the messages we wanted to say. And we kind of found our community through the DIY queer scene in London. And then, like, Afropunk kind of picked us up. But yeah, I think, you know, you do, like, as Miles was saying, like, you do find your people. I think London, like, if you live here, you're very blessed because you can, you know, just hang out or go to certain gigs and you meet people that are interested. And I feel like NTS as well, like, that's definitely opened up my world to people who have the same musical interests as me. But yeah.
Yeah, do you feel like, because it feels like, you know, there was unity in the tribes that people had back in the day. Because I feel like now it's nice that, you know, we have access to so much more, there are fewer boundaries, but we don't have tribes. It's a bit more kind of individual than perhaps it used to be. Is that something that you've noticed shifting? Anyone?
I was going to say, to be fair, I kind of felt like at a time there was like, you know, grungers and the rude boys and all that in school, and when I got older, I was kind of thinking, you know, I'm just gonna try and make it really open. And I was saying to a few people, like when I was getting my music together, that is my direction. But when we started talking about it, I was just like, there's already people, like the tribes are not like as clear cut as that, as like, you know, the rockers and the this and that. It's like I'll like a good example of that is Lava LaRue. She's just like, her tribe is so multifaceted, like in the things that they wear and the music that they listen to and the stuff that they're into. So it's almost like, I feel like the generations has taken the barriers, have kind of got more blurred and opened up, I guess, for friends just to be open to whatever they're into, you know. And I feel like the tribes, as you say, kind of blurred lines. It's more like friendship groups that are accepting of, you know, a friend who's just into like far out left field music, but on the surface they might look like, you know, like a road don who just wears a tracksuit and drives an Audi.
Mm.
But like, you know, like Kobe and Mika and all of that sort of crew, that's a great example of that. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, that's just a friendship group that are friends and they support each other in the fact of being into music. You can be into classical, you could be into some dub, but we're friends and we support each other. I think that's where it's at now, rather than it being so segregated. Because when I was in school, I was cool with everyone.
Mm.
I wasn't really like in, I guess I'd hang out with the grungers mostly, but I was just like, yeah, I'm from Shakespeare Road, mate. You know what I mean? You want to come and get some rice and peas? Like, we've got the same parent, you know, thing going on, but I might be into like, and you might be into that. You know what I mean? But we share that, you know? And I think like maybe my generation has made those sort of lines like less straight. It's just more way more open.
Mm.
That's where I think about it anyway.
Mm.
Don't know if you guys think the same or you know what I mean.
I feel like social media has kind of blurred the lines a bit. Like, I feel like, as you were saying, everything's so accessible. So, you know, like for me personally, I'll look at pictures of like Pauline, and then, or I could look at, you know, I can find anything I want. So I feel like there's a lot of mixing going on in our generation.
Yep. When I decided to be a reggae man, it was considered professional suicide because groups that were around at that time played a little bit of everything. And I said, no, we're just going to concentrate on reggae. Right, and I'm from Barbados. When I went back to Barbados, people were curious, why are you playing reggae? You know, because there, reggae had not been really, you know, it hadn't really blown up. And as you can see, I mean, our biggest singer is Rihanna. Right, and people were going, well, why are you doing that? And I said, I'm doing it because I can. And I want to, you know. And our first gig was in Alconbury at a US Air Force base where there was Royal Air Force and US Air Force, a combined base. And we got a first gig to play for the American section of it. And we were told, don't play any reggae. Right? So we came on with a Booker T and the MGs song. It's like going on. The next tune, stick it up, mister! Rain. Right? And then you could see the look on the Americans' faces. Like, what's this? Is this some kind of island music? And we said, yeah, this is how you dance to it. And we got the crowd going, and we had two gigs that night, one with the non-commissioned officers and one with the, you know, the officers. So when we got away with that in the non-commissioned, right, we were told, when you go to the officers, mate, don't play reggae. Right? So, we went on, like what, the first tune, a funk tune, right, you know, warm and chill the atmosphere, and then some heavy dub reggae. And we taught them how to dance to it.
Sweet.
And amazingly, we got a second booking a month later.
There you go. You loosened up the officers.
Yeah, we dubbed up the office.
Now, earlier you talked about the fact that you'd sort of, you know, rejected your dad's, you know, Jamaican music, as we all often we do, you know, there's a part of us that wants to, we have to sort of rebel a little bit against our parents. We have to show that we're different. And then you kind of go, oh, yeah, you know that record that you played me 3 years ago and I said it was rubbish, can I have it back?
I was a Hendrix fan. What changed? Well, at the time, people were saying that reggae could not be played in the UK and it wouldn't sound the same. And I was intent on proving that if you wanted to, you could do whatever you want. I mean, and my inference was, look at Jimi Hendrix, okay, where he's coming from after playing with Little Richard and the Isley Brothers and all that, and then he comes out with this monstrous guitar playing, you know, that, in fact, when he first played in a club called the Ram Jam in Brixton, it was John Mayall's Blues Breakers that were playing. He was just supporting, right? And when he was about to come on, all the members of John Mayall's band, including Eric Clapton and that, came out and sat in the front row. I thought, oh, let's have a look. And when this guy started to play the guitar, they were all, you know, because no one had taken it there. And I tried to, you know, emulate Jimi Hendrix. And then my friend George said to me, Dennis, all that Hendrix business, that ain't you. There's only one Jimi Hendrix and it's not you. Right? So I got a bit of a knock there. And he said, look, the next big thing is going to be reggae. And about that time, I was 15, 16, and it gave vent to dancing with girls.
Mm-hmm.
Not just like that, but hands-on. So I thought, this is the kind of music I want to make. You know, and then the old blues dances. I was fortunate enough to work in the art room at school and help print the school magazine. So I knew how to do typeset. I did typography. And I was approached by all the sound systems like Cox and Duke Reed, all the big sound systems, to print their invites to their blues dances. So I knew where all the blues dances were going to be, and I would share that information with my friends. You know, and then the school had a recording studio, and that studio was built to do sound effects for the school's drama group. And I was quite high up in the drama group, but then when no one was looking, I started sampling tunes. And a hit record at the time was Bob and Marcia, Young, Gifted and Black. And I'd been reading that George Martin had been doing loops with the Beatles. So I thought, good idea. So I borrowed a couple of bars out of the verse inside of that tune, edited it together, and then I got one of the teachers from the music, because we had a full orchestra as well. I was fortunate. My dad made me go to that school, and I'm very glad that he did. Mm. And I got one of the masters to play trombone and flute, and we did a dub version of Guantanamera. Right. Yeah, and I took it to a blues dance one night, and there was a sound system called Jim Daddy. And Jim Daddy was, you know, playing, and I said, Jim, put that on. And he put it on, and he went, I guess it's mine. How much do you want for it? I'll give you £3. So we took the £3, right? And got a taxi home. And that was the beginning of me sampling bits. And there was a Booker T and the MGs tune called Bootleg. So I figured, well, that they called it Bootleg. It's to be bootlegged.
Straight.
Yeah, straight.
Amazing. Pauline, you know, you talked about this sort of moment, you know, when in the 70s and 80s, this sort of moment of, you know, the Conservative government just coming in, Thatcherism, this sort of, there was a sort of very politically charged time. do you see resonances with that sort of moment and the sort of moment that we're in now? And, you know, do you feel, you know, obviously at that time, music was a vehicle, a way of people connecting, a way of people resisting. Do you feel like it sort of can work in the same way now?
I'd like to see it working in the same way now. I'm not young anymore.
Don't lie.
You know what I mean? It's kind of when you're young, you have your own speak. You talk to each other, you're doing things, you're not letting kind of necessarily the older generation know what on earth is going on and stuff. So I can't really speak in that way. I'd like to see that happen. I'd like to see people get rid of this charlatans that are running us basically at the moment. You know, because the future is theirs and they have some very tough decisions to make. And those tough decisions are always made easier if you've got some really good music going on at the time, just to kind of, you know, soften everybody up to those ideas and all of that. But do I see that? I can't say I honestly see it, but I hope it's there. And there's one thing I know about having lived so long is that there's always some music happening somewhere which is progressive. It's never goes into music that, well, you know. So there'll be somebody somewhere who's doing that kind of thing, you know, in the same way. It's like when you were talking about when we went to America for the first time, we'd find ourselves in the Midwest or, you know, some bloody place in Texas because we were a mixed band and all of those things going on after a wet T-shirt competition. And most of the people who were in the audience were white and wearing 10-gallon hats or however many gallon hats they wear and wearing cowboy boots. And they'd stand there puzzled looking at us thinking we've never seen anything like that. Because you've got to remember that was about 10, 11 years after the Civil Rights Movement. And we all know what went down during that. And so you really felt like you weren't preaching to the converted here. You were going to have to convert these people. And normally we'd always have them kind of, you know, dancing away, not knowing what they were necessarily dancing to, but because it was such an infectious rhythm, they didn't really check the lyrics. So that was fine. Just as well, really.
Liminal messaging.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And then, you know, likewise, I'd always wanted to play in New Orleans. We got the chance to go to New Orleans and play. And when we walked in there, it was like everybody had turned up from church. A load of black people sort of sat there, you know, in all their finery and fur coats and hats on the ladies and all this kind of thing. And they thought they were going to hear a band from Britain, you know, a black band from Britain sort of thing. And then we turned up. Well, that was a bit kind of... That was actually worse than the wet T-shirt. but nonetheless, we won them over in the end. So it was so diverse all that time that was the real formative kind of thinking that I had for what Two Tone is about and actually bringing people together in those ways who didn't know they wanted to be together. And that's largely it, isn't it? People don't know that they want to be together, but that's the one good thing about music. Music is that vehicle that enables that to happen. So
you do feel that the sort of the music that you made at that time and that kind of movement, did you feel like it did impact society at large?
Yeah, because people still come along to gigs and talk about it. And it's still being talked about. Just that, really. I don't know whether they'll still be talking about it in 100 years' time.
Of course they will.
I hope they'll be talking about all your music. But yeah, I hope so. I hope that it's part of this whole kind of, you know, passing the baton, because that's what it's really about.
When I first met Linton Kwesi Johnson, friends said, that's not going to catch on, because he was very monotone, and his topics were very, very political. In fact, there was a time when there was a program that we made for telly, that our program was taken off, and to be replaced by a political broadcast by the Conservative Party. Because they felt that anyone who listened to Linton would not have voted Conservative. And I'm sure they're right. Yeah. And Linton, when I first met him, he presented me with this poem. It's like, England is a bitch. I'm like, what? England is a bitch. And then when I dug deeper into it, he was talking about someone who'd come over and been working on the underground. Me also work on the underground. But working on the underground, you don't get to know your way around. England is a bitch, right? And then he spelt it I-N-G-L-A-N. So he wasn't talking about England, but was England. Also, when he started writing in his Jamaican patois style, my dad said to me once, your friend Linton. I said, yeah. He said, went to university, did he? I'm like, yeah. He's going, shame he didn't learn to spell. But that was my dad being, you know, objective about my friends and who I was hanging out with. And at one point he thought, you've gone a bit too Jamaican, son. I was going, well, that's all right. You know, but with Linton and his politicalness, I felt an affinity with what he was saying because I'd seen that kind of thing happen. Mm. And he had been in that kind of thing. I mean, where he'd gone on a demonstration and the police busted the crowd and he ended up in prison, you know, being hit by a policeman because he was exercising his right to peaceful process, you know, protest, sorry. And I felt that what he had to say was very important and had to be heard by all. And in fact, one night we were in a place called Stuttgart in Germany, and someone in the audience shouts out, Linton, what? England is a bitch. And he responded, I know. What about Germany? And it was hush. You know.
Incredible. Well, it still is a bitch, unfortunately.
Hey. Hey.
I mean, Miles, we've spoken before about, you know, because with your last record, you know, you really found your scream. Yeah. And, you know, we've spoken about the fact that you know, when you're on tour, you were sort of inviting people up to come and, like, partake in this sort of collective scream.
100%.
As a way of sort of letting it out, you know.
Yeah, man. Because, you know, when you're, like, making kind of hardcore-ish music or you're screaming in school and whatever, like, you know, you're chatting to prejudice and that, you're like, you like this, don't you? That stuff, that kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, okay, you know, obviously you can kind of, like, relate that to being sort of, like, talking about dark stuff and being kind of weird or whatever. But it's an exfoliation, man. It's like sometimes you can't describe it in words. Sometimes it's literally just like a, you know, you might feel better afterwards. And I kind of, like, before I do a gig and stuff, I'll go in the crowd and I'll just kind of meet people and something. Some people wouldn't really know if come there to hear the album or whatever. And I spoke to this one guy, and he was just like talking about one of the tunes and expressing how it spoke to him on a level that was completely what I wasn't going for on the song. And he said it helped him through like a few times of bringing it in his head a bit too much. I said, listen, man, look, there's a mic on the stage, you know. When we play South, which will be the last tune, which will be like the scream tune, if you feel like it, just come and grab the mic. In fact, grab the mic. There's enough people jumping in the crowd. You know what I mean? Just because it's like, I'm not just doing it for you know, some people to be like, oh, have you heard the screamy guy? I'm doing it because it's just like, when I was recording it, I was like, I was with my friend Phoebe, and I was like, Phoebe, I don't even know how I feel about, or how I can write down. I'm not like a rapper, or I'm not like great with the lyricism, but sometimes it's just like, nah. Mm. And I would come off the stage most of the time after finishing that tune, just tired, just like ready to go to bed, almost just like I've just, you know, been to the gym, you know what I mean? Because I feel like I've got it out. And, sometimes I've got to find myself in that headspace to be able to deliver it. But I feel like there's always going to be someone out there who can relate to or who might need that. Mm. You know what I mean? Not just for the sake of what I'm saying in the song or whatever, because sometimes... Because what I'm talking about in the songs is about Brixton and about gentrification and feeling like my ends has just completely changed over, like, the last 10 years. Like, oh, where's Pizza Hut gone? It's now, you know... Or where's Red's records gone? That's how I felt. I feel pissed off. Do you know what I mean? But someone else might just have a day of, like, I need this. So just invite it out, man. You know what I mean? Let them people express how they feel. You know? It might not. It might be in England as a bitch. It might be in that sort of, like, dialogue. Or it might just be in, like, it can be a proper solemn song. But I'm just... You're getting something out of it. And that's what I'm always trying to express, man.
Mm.
And to try and encourage people to do. Because, you know, I've put out a song where I'm screaming loads. But the next record, trust me, it's chill. It's so relaxed.
Solo folk guitar.
Yeah, that's the vibe. That's actually the vibe.
I'll be buying it.
Yeah, you know what I mean? But there's inside all of it, there's something to get. Like, I'm just trying to let something out. I'm just trying to let emotion out. I'm trying to, like, relate to anyone. And it might not be the lyrics, it might be the notes. I was playing a song to my friend's son a couple of years ago. Wasn't singing anything, but I was just kind of playing. He was like 9 years old. He just started crying. I was like, Riley, you all right, bro? He said, why are those chords so sad? I was like, I don't know, man. I'm actually thinking, like, it makes me feel quite good, actually. But, you know, he's getting that from the thing, so you kind of, like, sometimes, you know, try and lean towards that. And I guess, you know, what we were talking about earlier about the punk thing, that's why I can feel like the jazz can be punk, you know, because I was chatting to a friend of mine a few years ago, his name's Quake Bass, and he spoke about a band called United Vibrations, and it's called Kareem. And get me, broccoli. And he said to him, like, when because he's in a band called Speaker's Corner, when they were doing that, he said to him, instrumental music is going to be the future, bro. Like, almost like dub, you know what I mean? It's like taking away the lyrics and letting the emotions and the stories come through the notes and the movement of it. That's going to be the future. And when he said that, I was just like, bruv, you know what? You got something there. And you know, I'm dyslexic. I'm crap at spelling, you know what I mean? But I will play the guitar and play one note. I can play the same note, bend it, you know, play it a little bit soft, but you might know how I feel or what I'm trying to say to you. You know what I mean? I feel like that is... I think I went on a tangent then. But, yeah, that's where I'm at. You know what I mean?
Well, also, because, you know, that record was sort of... It came out of a time of, you know, extreme tension, the pandemic, you know, political upheaval. We're again living in quite trying times, and it feels like there is almost a sort of collective need for that scream. You know, there was the sort of sheeny 90s and early noughties, and it feels like that kind of grittier sound is sort of coming back, or at least in the sort of scenes that I feel sort of connected to.
Yeah.
Is that something you're aware of? Is that something that you've kind of noticed, Delilah?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I just moved to Deptford, and I thought all the, like, apart from the Brixton Windmill, there wasn't really any punk venues, but... I completely forgot about the Bird's Nest, and I'm very lucky I get to hear, like, the hardcore, like, punk all the time. But, yeah, like, unfortunately, like, with gentrification in this city, there's a lot of, like, DIY venues that have been closed down just, like, in the last decade. But, yeah, I think it definitely comes down to people, like, using their initiative and, like, getting together, like, Wooly, Miles does, and... Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I definitely feel like in the pandemic, there was a need for, like, going against it. It's like, I tried so hard to organise. I was just like, a friend of mine showed me a video of someone's music video. I was like, we need a truck, with an open back. And we're just going to get in the back, get a generator, and just drive around and start playing music. Because people need to hear this right now. But we didn't do it, because, I mean, you know. But we did other stuff. And I feel like around the pandemic, and I feel like everyone got to slow down and got to be like, you know what? What do I want to do? I don't actually want to do this job no more. I want to, like, you know, I feel like that was a real time that needed to have a voice. And I feel like there was a lot of things came out of that, positive things. So there's a lot of, lots of negative things, to be able to, you know, pave the way for a different way of thinking, I think. I mean, that was for me, to be honest. I think that, you know, out of mad things come, you know, diamonds in the rough, man. Out of, you know, rough with the smooth, all of that sort of stuff. I think it's important to be able to just, like, find your voice inside the mist of a madness. You know what I mean?
Preach.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And actually, to be honest, in the pandemic, that's when we actually went to go and write the record, because we managed to go over to Norway, and it was like being able to watch what was going on in London from a faraway place, like literally watching the TV and in the studio, like, that's mad, isn't it?
Like, converting it.
You know what I mean? But we were like locked away in there. So it was like really interesting time. You know, yeah.
Dennis, you know, you've kind of observed this, you know, you've been making music and performing for a very long time, and you've been so heavily involved in these very kind of DIY scenes. Do you think that that kind of DIY spirit and ethos is still with us? Is it still here? Is it living?
Very much so. In fact, my youngest daughter, when she was at secondary school and showing signs of wanting to enter into the recording arena, I was fearful that she was going to be out all hours of the night, you know, a young girl in recording studios, you know. So what I did was I built a studio at home for her to use. So I said, any recording you have to do, bring your friends to the house. And I can vet them then. So she learned how to manipulate the machines. And she's currently making music. And she calls herself L Dot. And I forget the name of this, some young girl, something Bond, that she's Etta just...
Bond.
Yeah, Etta Bond.
Etta Bond.
Etta Bond, yeah. She's been featured on the new Etta Bond record.
Hey.
Right, and... she went on a TV program with some friends just to be one of the audience, and it was the late-ish show, Mo Gilligan. And then I was about to go off somewhere, and she said, Dad, I went on that Mo Gilligan show. I'm going, yeah, and what happened? She went, my friends put me up to go rapping with N Dubs, right? And I won two tickets to a weekend or something to New York. I'm like, wow, that's incredible. Because, but they don't know I'm your daughter. Good, don't tell anybody.
Next generation, but rise
up. I've heard her now, yeah. But, and my eldest son, who lives in Denmark, in Copenhagen, he's been a priest and a policeman. Well, the other way around, he was a policeman first, and he said to me, you and Linton are always going on about how the police are corrupt. I'm going to do something about it from inside. I was like, son, you're going to get yourself killed. And he was working for the Police Complaints Authority, and I said, you're definitely going to be in trouble, because the public don't like you because you're a policeman, and the policemen don't like you because they know that you're a policeman's policeman. And then he said, yeah, after 3 years, he resigned. So what are you going to do now? He went to do his master's in theology and became a priest. And after about 5 years or so, he said, I'm fed up with this. And he started making music, because his first degree was at Westminster University in music. And I thought, yeah, my son's... play trombone. I was like, yeah, that's my boy. And I took him around to, he joined the youth orchestra, right? And I had to go with him where he was playing. He was only like 12 or 13. And then one day at a concert, in a quiet piece of the music, I heard, and I say to his sister, that's your brother. She goes, how can you say that about your own son? When he comes off, I say to him, did you make that horrible... We go, yeah, I forgot it was a quiet piece of the music and I was blowing out the trombone. Now, he's just finished a video And he said, Dad, you've got to be in this video. So I'm going, no, I'll make your tune by yourself, man, right? He's going, no, you've got to be in this video. So he's come over and he's rented an open-top car. And 8 o'clock that morning when we're supposed to do the video, it's pouring with rain.
Mm.
And he said, don't worry, I've got a weather forecast. The sun's going to come out at 2 o'clock. I'm like, all right, then. And he calls me at 1:30 and he goes, right, you ready? And the sun comes out and I find myself in an open-top car driving around London through Buckingham Palace. And when you see it and people go, where's that? And go, London. And the sky's so blue, it's unreal, you know. And this tune, it has a kind of dazzling effect. And he's just written a new tune called Stranger Than Fiction. And it's all about the, you know, the epidemic.
Mm.
And he's saying that there was policemen on patrol saying that the world is closed. And I'm thinking, man, you're writing some lyrics here, dude. You know.
Sorry to cut you off, but I'm just worried. We're a bit running low on time. And I know that if people want to ask questions, we probably might have time for just a couple. So are there any questions in the audience? And if you could, like, wave your hand around so that I can see you. We should have time for a few. Oh, there's one, the person in the... Yeah, there you go.
There's always a bit of pressure with, like, the questions. I'm trying to, like, formulate it. But you talked a lot about, you know, your experience in musical and political movements and comparatively how you feel now with, you know, communal endeavors to have a political voice as, you know, a youth. And I was wondering, for all of you, I guess whoever wants to pick up the question, is what differences have you experienced in terms of creators finding a collective space in a time where individualized affirmation is really important through social media? So how do we find that value as communities, as, you know, pre-internet days, when so much is attached to our own individual identities? And how can, you know, music of Black origin continue to thrive as a community versus, you know, the individual, how many likes do I have, and that sort of ego that we all have that dominates a lot through the creative process? I would love to know your lived experience around this.
Well, I'll start. I think to answer that question, that if you can't beat them, join them. And it might be bad to say this, but I think our generation is going a certain way. And you can go against the tide, but I think if you bring that activism to social media in a genuine and authentic way, it can work and you can reach people that you might not even reach. So it's a bit of a gift and a curse, I think, in that sense. But yeah, if anyone wants to add on to that.
I definitely think it's a gift and a curse in terms of, like, I don't really go on there unless my manager's like, bro, yeah, come on. Give us some story, give us some information about yourself. Because I feel like you can get stuck in the death scrolling, man. You can just be there forever doing it and then thinking, oh, they're doing really well and how many numbers have they got? It's natural, right? But I feel like if you've just got a collective sort of trajectory among you and the people that you love creating with, just to kind of like ignore it, then it will play in your favour. It'll be like, oh yeah, we don't do that. And then people will be like, oh yeah, you're into those guys who don't do that. It's kind of dope, right? We should maybe check that out too. So it's like a bit of a, you know, give and take, because I want to be speaking to people that are, or younger people from my brother and sister's generation, but they are on the phone, man. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I guess just the same way that we have Bluetooth headphones, I know young people who want the headphones with the wires because they look to what was before and trying to have a connection with that. So I guess it's a way of how to, you know, find your feet in both worlds and kind of remind people that there was a life before of all of the you know, sort of likes and all that sort of crap, man. Because it's just kind of long. really.
I just like to talk to people. I mean, it's not really... I'm really not that good at Instagram or any of those kinds of things. I mean, we have a presence there, but really just to tell people there's a gig on, or when you're touring or you've got a new record out and stuff like that. So I think people of my generation probably use it in a relatively mundane way. But talking to people is still the way. I mean, I always, before we do a gig, I just go out on the merch stand and I talk to people and invite them to ask me questions, you know. We don't charge them for this. I know that there's many people of my generation who now charge 100 quid to get an autograph of people and stuff like this. No, you don't. You just go out, you just talk to people. But they're there, they're flesh and blood. And they'll come up with all kinds of questions that you have to answer in that moment. And you will then go and read social media maybe a bit later and they say, oh, God, she's up herself, isn't she? Or whatever. Do you know what I mean? But in the main, it's always good. And I don't think there's any substitute for that, really. Mm. But it's how you find people, you know? I mean, if you're used to social media and finding people that way, then great. You know, if you're an influencer, just make sure what you're influencing people with has some bloody substance, you know, not just your own notion of how the world might be. It's just that, really.
Mm. Well, I've been dobbed into lots and lots of groups where people are sending me to, and I don't read any of it. When I wake up in the morning, I thought, right, now's the time to clean my phone. Off, 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 off. And then the one time that I read something, it was an email from a man called Peter Smith from in LA, and he was telling me that he was managing, I knew Peter from the days of the Beastie Boys, and he was telling me that he was managing a rock band called Spoon, and that they were interested in doing a dub album with me. So I was like, oh, I'm glad I didn't rub that off. And so the only way that we could collaborate on making this dub album, they're in Austin, Texas. So I'd go to the studio at 12 o'clock, and they, it would be 6 a.m. for them. And then by 6 p.m., they'd be awake and talking to me on WhatsApp about what they liked about the mix or what they didn't like or what they wanted me to redo or something. And I found that it, without social media, well, without WhatsApp and that, I couldn't have done that. Mm. I mean, Mr. Greenwood, Johnny Greenwood, called me up one day and said, Radiohead is no more. We've got a new band, and it's called The Smile, okay? And we've just recorded our first single. I mean, I'm good. He's going, I'm sending it to you with a view to you mixing it. In fact, here are the stems. I could hardly say no, you know. And then after about 9 mixes, when he finally said, it's glorious, I thought, stop there then. But that, all that was, you know, communicating on social media. Now, that's fine, but when people get on and rant about things, I think, at first line, I mean, rub off that.
Hear, hear. I'm wondering, have we got time to squeeze in one more question? Yes, okay, brilliant.
You've all spoken eloquently about the past and you've delved into technology. So I'm just curious, across all of you, the impact of AI and its ability to appropriate music culturally. So what we're now in is a new dawn. I'm just curious as to how you respond to this new dawn of AI.
It worked for me because I've just been mixing some new Max Romeo songs. And in one of the songs, you see, the publisher had got Max to sing these tunes. And one of the tunes is Kingston Town. You know, Kingston Town, that song, UB40 made a big hit out of that. And Max Romeo's just done his own version. But I spotted that When he said, when I am king, surely I will need a queen and a palace and everything. And he had said, which made me think he was dyslexic, he said, instead of saying, and a palace, he went, and a place. So I thought, hey, that word is palace, not place. So I can't mix the tune because it's not the right lyric. The publisher suggested AI. And we made it work just to say the word palace. And I think it's fine.
There's no way of taking away like humanism to anything. You can try, you can sound pretty dope, but you know, you're hitting, as you're saying, hitting a match. I mean, mate, AI can, it's not ever gonna, it will try, but hey man, I guess it's that whole thing of like the love for doing it yourself, the whole DIY culture. You can never get rid of that. You know, a computer can try it, but they're only going to try and imitate what they think a human is going to do.
But maybe AI is DIY culture.
Eh?
Maybe AI is DIY culture, because you can download
true.
And do it yourself.
Ah, you're right there, mate. Yeah.
Just throwing that in.
Yeah. Curveball. Sharp, Marsden.
You could be right, Frank Sinatra.
100%. I guess we're the generation of LimeWire. Know what I mean?
Okay.
So I guess that there's a DIY thing in there too.
Mm. I just kind of see it as it's here now.
Mm. Yeah.
It isn't. I mean, when the internet first turned up, no one knew how to use it. None of us did. I mean, you know, trying to www. I mean, it was ludicrous at the beginning. And now none of that is. We've all learnt the language and we've all found new and wonderful ways to use it. And I think maybe look at it in that way, that there are ways to use it, but we've got to kind of sort that out. And maybe in 10 years' time, we'll all be sitting here. Well, some of us might be sitting here. And talking about AI as something that actually helps us as opposed to hinder us. Mm. I think we're just looking at all the negative aspects of it at the moment because we haven't sorted out yet what may be the positive aspects of it. So I would err on that side. I mean, people listened to crystal sets once, didn't they? You know what I mean? And no one thinks that's a good idea, do they?
The punk and rebel in me wants to just keep going and keep taking audience questions until we get kicked out and dragged off the stage. Can we get away with one more, or is that the end? One more, yes. Okay, so let's hope it's a good one. No pressure. I don't know. Can you, Michael, you decide. Thanks.
Okay, so I know Miles through, like, sound system culture. So in London, South London, Unit 137, he's got a lot of connections with people from there. But I wanted to ask Miles, like, what... Because I think that sound system is the biggest sort of, like, unifier at the moment in the reggae sort of scene in London and beyond. I have friends that are middle class people from like sort of Dorset who I'm like really close with and see more times a week than my friends that I speak to see in London all the time. But yeah, what do you think about sound system culture and its like its importance and value in the future?
I think someone mentioned I was doing some work with a few friends of mine, and I think that sound system from where it was back in the day, it's like going to church for some people, you know what I'm saying? But I feel like that bringing together of community is what I would take from it. Because, I mean, as you're saying, Unit 137, back in the day, it was like only Joe, and it was a big scene at the jam in Brixton. But it wasn't just, you know, people doing like reggae and ska. It was opened up to a community that liked that kind of music, but was also like in the peripheral stuff around it. And if, again, I guess just a just goes back to community, and I feel, and as I said earlier, I think community is like one of the biggest nurturers of new stuff, you know what I'm saying? So I think it's very, very important to be able to learn from what that did for the generation before us and taking it on and seeing what it can do for, you know, the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the sound system was definitely the unifier. Because in blues dances, that was the first place you'd see people of all different denominations and colours and all that coming together to dig what was being played.
Yeah, man. And, like, you know, you got rave culture that will kind of apply to, like, you know, people staying up all late and maybe getting a little bit naughty with things and that. But, you know, like, one of the most euphoric moments I ever had was going to Shaka with my girlfriend at the time, with my dad, with my stepmom, and it wasn't just like, you know, get a ticket, walk in the rave. It was like there was patties, there was tea, there was a place where you could buy records, a place where you can go and chill, and we were there till 7 a.m. just because of that level of like
atmosphere.
Yeah, man. And just it wasn't just about going out and like buying a ticket, going for a rave, and just going, all right, cool, that's done now. It's like I felt like I was at home. I felt like there was that kind of like hugging energy, and there's people from all different kinds of backgrounds there.
Yeah.
So yeah, rest in peace, Shaka boy.
Rest in peace, Shaka. And long live the sound system.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Well, you know, just thinking about the sound system and this, you know, as physical spaces where we can come together, where we can share ideas, where we can galvanise each other to have the strength to go out and fight the fights that we need to fight or to make the music that we need to make. And I think, you know, that's so crucial, and it's been a, you know, massive part of all of your stories. And I hope that that continues and that the energy of this collective happening, you know, is sort of, you take it with you into the rest of the night, whatever you're doing, the rest of your week, and able to fight the good fight, whatever that might look like for you. Join me in thanking my panel, Rulu, Dennis, Favelle, Delilah Holiday, and Pauline Black. And big love. And big love, of course, to Nicholas Daly for inviting us all to share in this
big
conversation.
Up
big up to Nicholas. Yes, and have a wonderful night, whatever you end up doing. See you later. Yeah.
Yeah, man.